Hello to all. That song seemed to be an appropriate one for this time of the year. The latter part of the first verse said, "Our shelter from a wintry blast." We're all sitting here shaking and shivering, although it seems to be a little bit warmer today than it has been. Well, I don't have any jokes to tell. I'll have to leave them and write them for Steve, but we'll get into the sermon for this afternoon. And for those of you who secretly desire it, I may even quit a little early. We've written and talked an awful lot in the Church of God about the nature of God many, many times. Usually it's more or less theological, academically you might say. Is God monotheistic? Is he binary? Is he triune? Is he polytheistic? You know, is there one, two, three, or many, many gods? Well, today I don't want to deal with that at all. I think we're all convinced of that, but I don't want to talk about it today. Instead, today I'd like to talk about the characteristics of God. The characteristics of God. If God were to walk into the room today, and you were to walk over to him, either the Father or Jesus Christ, to engage him in conversation, I wonder what your reaction would be if you walked over and said, "Have we met before? I haven't seen you here before. Have we met before? Do I know you?" Probably they would say, "Well, I'm not sure I know you, but I'm not sure if you know me." But what if we walked over to God, if he came into the hall this afternoon and introduced ourselves? What would you expect to discern about God? Would you be impressed or disillusioned? I don't think you might not be. We all might be a little bit. Often when we meet a celebrity, if you've met many celebrities, whether political, military, business, athletic, opera, either an actor or an actress, a writer or a minister, after initially being sufficiently awed and impressed, we ultimately come away somewhat disillusioned because we see their imperfections that we hadn't seen from a distance before. In 2005, Peter Jennings died. Most of you have heard of Peter Jennings. He was the anchor of the ABC News, evening news, for 22 years. Jennings was tall. He was extremely handsome. He was very eloquent, wealthy. He was socially and culturally influential. And he was one that most people wanted to meet. They say that when Peter walked into a room, there was kind of an aura about him. I don't know if you've met people like that, but there's just an aura that follows them, and you're automatically attracted to that individual. And they usually were just naturally gravitating toward him. Well, there was a two-hour tribute to him made sometime shortly after his death. And in that two-hour tribute, in which many of his friends and colleagues spoke very warmly and respectfully of him, there was a little other information that was kind of subtle and beneath the surface. A few of the items in his life became very discreetly evident. Some probably knew about it, but maybe others didn't. A brief, very brief mention was made of his first marriage, because he had more than one, from which he had two children. Nothing more was even said about that marriage. A second marriage was talked about somewhat, but her last name was not his last name. I'm not sure what the relationship was, but they talked about a marriage. A few times it was mentioned that women often threw themselves at him. He was so handsome, so knowledgeable, so articulate, so talented, and so sexually attractive. Perhaps that was a dark side of his life that was kind of just glossed over in the tribute to him because of his news reporting prowess. During the evening news hour in April of that year, Peter Jennings mentioned or revealed one of his shortcomings. He actually came out and mentioned one of his faults, one of his sins. He had lung cancer, and he explained why he had lung cancer. He had smoked for many, many years. Not that that's a sin in this society, but it is a sin against their body. And he began to realize that because he was dying, and he knew he was dying, and he was dying because he had lung cancer because of his smoking for many, many years. He had been a heavy smoker in his younger years. He stopped, and then under the pressure and the stress of 911, which was right in the area where he was that day, he started again. And in 4 months, he died of lung cancer from smoking. Well, his case is not unusual. Almost without exception, once you get acquainted with and get beyond the aura of the celebrity, you find flaws, because they're human. You find weaknesses. You may find sins. And to one degree or another, you are disillusioned. So again, I ask the question, what if God walked into the room today and you walked over to him, stuck out your hand and said, have we met before? And began to engage him in conversation, not knowing who you were talking to. After talking for a while, what idea toward him would you have? Would you be impressed? Or would you be disillusioned after you truly got to know God the Father and Jesus Christ? Well, in the sermon this afternoon, let's take a look at God and see what he says about himself, what he's like, because he talks a lot about himself. Now, usually we don't like to be around people who are always talking about themselves, but you'll find in reading the Bible that God talks an awful lot about himself, but it's not in an arrogant way. I think once you see that, you'll be genuinely impressed. The first point to look at, which we'll turn to Exodus 3, verse 14 to begin, in talking to God and in becoming better acquainted with God, you are stricken by his confident, super confident, yet truly humble carriage. Now that is a remarkable combination that you just don't find very often anywhere. A super confident attitude, and yet a very truly humble carriage of his person. Let's look at Exodus 3, verse 14. This is where Moses, as far as we know, met God for the first time. God had been aware of him for many, many years. And finally, he introduced himself to Moses. You find in verse 1 it said Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, and you realize in studying the chronology of Moses that he was around 80 years of age at this time. Not a very successful person in one time. At this time, he had been in the very highest of kingdoms in Egypt for 40 years. He made a stupid mistake when he killed a man. He fled, and now for 40 years he had been on the backside of nowhere taking care of the sheep. And it was at this low point in his life that God introduced himself to Moses, an angel or messenger from God, in this case, the Lord of the Old Testament. It was a burning bush, as you know, and Moses said, I've never seen that before. I think I'll turn aside and find out what's going on. And when God saw that he turned aside, and then it says God called him, or God introduced himself to Moses. And let's see, told him, be careful where you tread. The ground on which you're standing is hallowed ground. And he said in verse 6, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when Moses realized to whom he was talking, it said he hid his face. He was afraid to even look on God. And then you read through the other verses that God explained to him. He understood what was going on in the nation. And coming down to verse 14, well, Moses, he told him, I'm going to send you to the Israelites. And he said, well, what's your name? When they say, who sent you? I've got to have a name to tell them who sent me to you. What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, and I think sometimes we don't realize the significance of what God said in telling Moses what his name was. It doesn't make any sense the way it's put in the King James Version. God said to Moses, tell them, I am that I am. Now, in this sense, it sounds like arrogance. I am that I am, or I will be what I will be. But the Hebrew means, I will be what I will be, or I am what I am. It implies eternity and self-existence. Now, you think about that for a little bit. An individual says to you, who is this celebrity, I've always been, and I am all-powerful. I am self-existent, and I've always been. That's what he said. That is my name, the Eternal. That's why we call him the Eternal. And he said, I'm the God of your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. I am that I am. I am the self-existing, ever-living, all-powerful, almighty being. Now, on the human level, some 60 years ago, I think, no, not that far back, there was one who was famous by saying always, I'm the greatest. But he is a shriveled old man these days, shaking and shivering because of the excess that he performed in his life. But God says, I am the Eternal, I'm the Almighty, I have always been, I always will be, and I am the most powerful of all. I'm the God of your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That is my name. You know, that's quite an impressive meeting of an individual you've never met before. There is one more in Isaiah 44, verses 6, 7, and 8, where God explains a little more about himself, his quality, as I said, his qualities and his characteristics. In Isaiah 44, we'll start in verse 6. God is talking about himself. In verse 6, it says, Thus says the Lord, which is the Eternal, the Almighty, the King of Israel, I am the first, I am the last, and beside me there is no God. I'm all there is, he said, I'm the only one. Now we know that God is a family. There's God the Father and there's God the Son. And ultimately we know there will be other gods who will be sons. But here he said, I am the last and beside me there is no God. And then one other, and then we'll come to the point on this. In Isaiah 46, beginning in verse 9, the first few verses of Isaiah 46, you'll find in verse 1, he starts talking about the God of Babylon, Bel and Nebo, and they were idols, and they had to be carried on their beasts. They were a load for animals to carry. They were a burden to the weary beast. And then in verse 3, he said, Listen to me, Jacob, the house of Israel, who are born by me. You don't carry me, I carry you. And then he said, Even of your old age I am he, to the hoary hairs I will carry you. I've made you, I'll bear you, I will carry you and deliver you. And then he says and asks the question, To whom will you liken me? To whom will you make me equal and compare me that we may be like? And then he starts talking again about these other gods, which really aren't any gods. They lavish gold out of the bag that weighs silver in the balance. They hire a goldsmith, and he makes it a god. They fall down and they worship what they just made. They bear him on the shoulder. They carry him and set him in his place. But he says, I'm going to bear and carry you. Then coming to the point, in verse 9, talking about himself, Remember the former things of old. I'm God and there's none else. I'm God and there's none like me. I can even tell you from the beginning what the end is going to be like. Now, usually if some person tells us that, we know he's lying. But God said, I can tell you the conclusion before it ever starts. My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Now, as I said, God's name is the self-existing eternal one. That sounds a little arrogant if you just look at it academically. I'm the only one. Beside me, there's no one greater. I'm the eternal. I've always been. I always will be. And I'm the God of your ancestors. Sounds a little arrogant, and especially if it's the first time we ever met him. But it isn't arrogant at all. You'll find that he was, you may remember the verse in Numbers 23, verse 19, where Balaam was talking to Balak, and he said, God is not a man that he should lie. God was not lying at all. God tells the truth always. You can trust what he says. Even though from our human perspective, it sounds like he has an ego that cannot be contained, it's not so. He is, as he said, my name is, I am that I am. I will be what I will be. I am, I have always been, I always will be, and I am all powerful. Beside me, there's no one greater. First time to meet him, and you find all that out about him. God is also a being of great accomplishments, and yet he talks of those accomplishments in a very eloquent but objective, humble way about all of them. Let's notice this in Job 38. I won't go through the whole thing as we have sometimes before, but just to hit a high point or two. In Job chapter 38, and this is the time where God, and you might say, finally introduced himself in a way that Job got the point. Verse 1, God answered Job, and he said in verse 3, I'm going to ask you some questions, and I'd like some answers. And then comes this blunt question, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Now, Job had been around for a long time. He had done a lot of things. He was well accomplished. He was a famous individual, a wealthy individual. And who knows? We don't want to accuse him. We can't condemn him. But it sounds like Job did have a little bit of ego, because he talked about the time he wished it was back in the times when he did things for the widows and people honored him and people were taken by him. And now as he sat on this pile of ashes, he was nothing, reminiscing at how great he had been before. And so God said, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you understand. I don't know how old Job was this time. Let's say he was 60, 80. Let's say he was 100 years old at this time. Have you ever tried to match up 100 to eternal into the past? Job said, well, I'm 100 years old. God said, oh, well, that's great. How many hundreds go into 10 trillion? How many hundreds go into eternal? So he said, gird up your loins, I have a few questions. Where were you anyway when I, the eternal, laid the foundations of everything else? In verse 6, he said, were the foundations fastened? Who laid the cornerstone? And he talks about his creation. And I don't know if I have in the several places in our home. I remember on July 69, lying on the couch in Gretna, Louisiana, watching the trip to the moon, and to see this picture of the moon. And also then to see the picture of the earth looking back, this beautiful orb in space hung on nothing. I couldn't see anything it was hanging on. Now I know when you see a chandelier hanging down and it's giving you light, you know there's a string tying it to the roof. But you look at the earth, there is no string. It's there in space, hung on nothing. And God said, where were you when I did all that? Now, he wasn't trying to humiliate Job at all. He was just trying to wake him up to realize he wasn't the big kahuna after all. which is a fault many of us men have, that ultimately we get around to believing that we're the big kahuna, someplace, sometime, somehow. "Where were you when I," he says over and over again. And you'll find this goes on through chapter 38 and 39, and then becomes a chapter 42. And again, this is an incident where God walked up, introduced himself to Job, and said, "Hello, my name is, I'd like to talk with you." And here is Job's reaction, how he saw God. Chapter 42, verse 1, Job answered and said, "I know that you can do all things, or at least academically I do. I know that nothing, not even a thought, can be withheld from you." And then coming down to verse 5, "I have heard about you by the hearing of the ear." But now, you know, experience is a great teacher. It's not always the best, but it's a very, very good one when we actually experience it. And he said, "Now my eye sees you." He grasped, after listening to all of this explanation of what God had done, and he compared what he had done, there was no comparison. And so his impression of God, he was duly impressed. He wasn't disillusioned. I think he may have been a little discouraged when he realized what he'd been doing. "Now that I see the difference," it says in verse 6, and I think we've misread verse 6 a lot, and it had to do with the old teaching we had about God putting something evil in man, which we call human nature, and it is naturally, inherently, from birth, hostile to God, and we are evil and rotten and filthy of and by ourselves. When in Genesis 1, after he created everything, or recreated it at that time, he said all things were very good. So Job finally saw the difference between what God had done and what he had done, and he said, "I now see you, my eyes see you. It isn't just I've heard about you, I see you. Wherefore I abhor." Notice the word "myself," at least in the King James, is in italics, meaning it never was there. It didn't necessarily mean that he abhorred himself. He may have felt stupid and silly, and who knows what adjective to put at that moment. But it says, "I abhor and repent in dust and ashes." I'm humiliated, I'm embarrassed, and it means that all, it says, "I repent in dust and ashes." A better rendering would be, "Since I can see the difference now, and I see how truly great you are, and you're all that you've ever claimed to be, and I have no way of matching you, I changed my mind, and I realize at last that I'm just dust and ashes, that I'm just a human being. I am not God. I am not equal to you in any way at all. I'm like you in some ways, but I'm not equal to you. There is no equality here. You're far above me. I'm humiliated and embarrassed because now I see I'm just a human being. I'm just a human being." He was duly impressed by God in the sense that he saw the difference, and he was humiliated. Not that God was trying to humiliate him, but you know, sometimes we humiliate ourselves by our foolishness. So once an individual realizes God's greatness, it doesn't take long to realize that this, meaning all that goes on, is God's show. This is God's show. I think a human example of this would be, maybe not so much now that he's retired, but Bill Gates, he and Paul Allen started Microsoft in, I don't know, late 70s or so. He's got 40 billion or so. Allen has about 17 to 20 billion. At that time, in the beginning, when they went public, they had 51% of the stock shares in Microsoft Corporation. In other words, they couldn't be removed. They were the boss. it was said that every Saturday Bill Gates called his managers and he just wanted to talk. Hello, this is Bill calling. And they knew that Big Bill was always watching because it was Big Bill's show. He and Paul owned it and they called the shots. I heard it said that Peter Jennings edited every presentation of each correspondence that was sent to him. It was to be done his way, or it wasn't done. It was the Peter Jennings show. Although it was called the ABC Evening News, it was the Peter Jennings show. And he did a pretty good job, too. I always enjoyed listening to Peter Jennings. As we realize the greatness of God, we realize that it is God's show. Why is that? Well, in Genesis 1, verse 1, it says, in the beginning, Hargrove created everything that ever had been. What translation was I reading anyway when I said that? In the beginning, God created the entire universe. And then you find in verse 26, it says he created his crowning creation, human beings made in his image, not yet God, but destined to become God. And you find in Hebrews 2, verse 10, it says that it was created, all that was created, and by him and for whom are all things created. That little three or four words section there, for whom are all things, is his show. One of the biggest mistakes that we as men and women and human beings make is to begin to elevate ourselves in importance. And as I said, speaking from the Hawaiian viewpoint, we are the big kahuna. And yet, we are taught in Matthew 6:33, we are taught by a couple of words, simple little words, that helps us to learn the lesson that this is God's plan, God's program. He is the greatest. He is the eternal. He has always been. He always will be. He will be what he will be. He is what he is. He is super confident, but he is not arrogant. He is just telling the truth in a very humble way, in a way we've never heard before. And a part of our prayer is, and it is the ending of the prayer, for yours is the kingdom. It isn't. Now, when I take over. Billy and I were invited by an individual for an evening meal one time years ago, and he said, Vernon, you know, if God ever allows me to, be in charge of this work, I'll be looking for good men like you. That put a little thought in my mind. Oh, he's looking to be the boss. He's looking to be the boss of the show, his show. But we are to pray, it is your kingdom, your glory, and your power forever. We don't pray, it's your kingdom, your power, and your glory until I come along and take over. But it is your power, your glory, forever. And then we say, Amen, which means exactly as I read it, exactly as I heard it, exactly as I said it. Amen means thus be it. Pretty soon we realize this is God's show. And yet, with all of that, greatness, from the human perspective, what appears to be arrogance and self-assuredness is nothing more than telling the truth in a straightforward, honest, academic way, truthful way. The longer we know him, the longer we stand there and talk to him and he talks to us, the more we realize how impeccable is his character. Hebrews 7, verse 26 says, Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 26, speaking of Jesus at this point, some words are used. As I said, what are God's characteristics? We read about his greatness. We'd be scared spitless, to use an expression, if we saw all of these powerful characteristics about him in our very face. But in Hebrews 7 and verse 26, it says, "For such a high priest became us who is holy." Now, we use the word sometimes, and I'll use it, not that I'm cursing, and I say, "Well, holy Toledo." Well, if you've been to Toledo, there's nothing holy about it. But it's an expression. Or holy cow. Well, if you've milked cows, there's nothing holy about a cow that's got a tail full of wet cuckoo burrs that she swats you in the face with. There are a lot of expressions, and some of them are, seem like cursing, where you use the word holy. Holy means, I don't know that we have English words that can sufficiently define holy, but impeccable, flawless, wonderfully great, holy, pure, wholesome. Speaking of him, this one who's always been, always will be, this one who says, "There's none beside me," this one who says, "This is my name forever," this one who says, "It's my show, it will be done our way," this one who is so great and who has engaged you in conversation, it is said of him that he is holy. And this seems almost blasphemy in the light of all that you read about what he got and how did and how terrified Israel was of what they saw him doing. Harmless. Now we think of sometimes as harmless. He's just a harmless old man. He's not going to do anything, just harmless, as if it's a flaw. Harmless means just that. He would not truly harm anyone. Unless, of course, they need some explaining done to them. Undefiled and separate from sinners, meaning he doesn't party with the sinners. He has his lifestyle and lives by it. We realize ultimately how impeccable is his character. In case we don't see the difference in these words, let's look in Galatians 5, where we see a vivid contrast of the results of human beings from the individual who hates God and from the beginning wanted to be God and tried to take over God's throne and became demented spirit beings who are vile and filthy and who hate man and who tries to get man to buy into his thinking and destroy man. Galatians 6, we all know this, but it's I'm in Ephesians, no wonder. Galatians 6 and verse 4. Would you believe it's Galatians 5? Would you believe it is Galatians 5? The deep snow and the bitter cold has done a little thing or two to my brain. You lie there and you're just shivering all the time. I thought I got away from the snow when we left Chicago and the snow, the lake effect snow. We're on the southern edge of Lake Michigan, and sometimes when the warm air hits the water and the cold, and you get snow, and Michigan City and Elkhart and the cities around there, the lake effect. I think just north of Michigan City, when we were getting a foot here, they were getting 3 feet of snow. Lake effect. I thought we got away from that when we came to Columbus. But it doesn't seem that we did. This last week has been really, really cold. Galatians 5, as I said, to see the contrast, Galatians 5 and verse 19 and then verse 22, it talks about the contrast between God's characteristics and the attitude of God's characteristics and the characteristics of those human beings who have bought in to the other way of life from that spirit being. It says the works of the flesh, and notice, if you wonder why television is so bad, because it's popular, because this is how they've been influenced. And it talks about the degradation of the human body and life by filthy and vile and despicable acts by human beings with human beings. And then you look in verse 22 where it says the attitude or the fruit, the results that come from using God's Spirit, which of course comes from Him and is the essence of God, is love, joy, and peace. It's almost impossible to visualize a society based on and filled with love, joy, and peace, because we've never seen it in a nation. Then it lists long-suffering. It talks about meekness and temperance. It says God is holy, harmless, undefiled. In other words, purity. Just a pure, wholesome, straightforward, all-powerful, almighty individual who's always been around, who's running the show, and whose show it is. Once we begin to grasp these qualities and characteristics, the way that He is and the way He's trying to get us to be, we soon realize, and especially when we see the men and women of old who were truly were great and who will be in His family, who, in a sense, played a game or two with God, thinking they could get away with some things because of what they were doing, and they wanted to do it. We soon realize that we don't play games with this being. Now, you can, but you pay the price. We can do anything we want, but we will pay the price. We soon realize that coming up against a being of this quality and characteristic, we don't play games. Why? Well, in Galatians 6, you will find in verse 7, it says, don't be deceived. Except a deceived person thinks they're right, but they're not. They're dead wrong. Don't be deceived. Don't be led astray. Don't let your mind get tricked. God is not mocked. Now, you can mock God all you want, but it doesn't make any difference to Him. He knows who He is. He said, I am who I am. I know who I am. I am the eternal. I've always been. I am the most powerful beside me. There is no other God other than Jesus Christ, God the Father. Don't be deceived. Now, we hear of Allah. We hear of the gods of India. We hear of the gods of the Buddhists. We hear of the gods of the Muslims. We hear of a lot of gods. And, well, I'll just choose another God. Things will work out. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. He already has it all. He's trying to share it. Now, that's hard to grasp because most of us try to keep it. You know, there is the abundance mentality and there's the scarcity mentality. Those who are of the scarcity mentality are always trying to hoard it, grab it, keep it so that nobody else can ever get it. But the abundance mentality is that there is enough to go around for all, and we will share. That's academically, that doesn't make sense at all. You got 10, you give up one. Any fool knows you got 9. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever an individual sows, he's going to reap that. That is one of the biggest awakening aha moments, I guess we all have, that God's way says, I'll give you exactly what you earn. You will receive exactly what you sow. You will reap exactly what you sow. There are absolutes, and that's one of the biggest absolutes. And only the fool thinks they're getting away with it. Don't be deceived, he said. David, King David, learned this, and I won't go to Psalm 51 where he talks about learning, but Psalm 18, and he makes a very wonderful statement. Psalm 18 and verse 1, he talks about his attitude toward God and what he would do. I will love you, eternal, my strength. I didn't say he was terrified, but listen, and he didn't want to get around God because God would slap him upside the head. I will love you, eternal. You're my rock and my fortress, and you're going to deliver me. You are my strength, and I trust in you. And he uses terms of war like a buckler or a high tower, sword, fortress, rock, deliverer. But then let's come down to verse 20. And this sounds a little self-righteous here, but we got another verse that shows what it means. It says, the Eternal rewarded me according to my righteousness. Ah, yes. I was the righteous one, and he took care of me because I was so righteous. According to the cleanness of my hands, he has repaid me. But coming down in verse 25, it says, with the merciful, now this is a quality and characteristic of God. Do you and I want to receive mercy? With the merciful, you will show yourself merciful. So if we want to receive mercy, we may have to give mercy occasionally. With an upright man, you will show yourself upright. With the pure, you will show yourself pure. And with the froward, who is arrogant and sarcastic and cynic and rebellious, with the froward, you will show yourself. In other words, we reap what we sow. There are certain absolutes. And David understood that in his life. And he said, I will love you. Because he knew that God could be, you know in advance what they're going to do. They are dependable. They are predictable. God is predictable because of his qualities that he will give to us according to what we do. That's why he never makes a wrong decision as to who's going to be in his family. He just looks at what they did and what they're doing. One of our characteristics is, and it has to do with the froward, they say, don't kid me, I can do anything I want to do. Which is true, we can. But there is a payday. We all want to know when payday is, and we want to know what we're going to be paid. Well, we can predict that too when we understand the qualities and characteristics of God because he is so dependable. Excuse me just a moment. Speaking of how great God is, how marvelous God is, how awesome and frightening in some respects, could you see yourself? They say one way to experience something is just to visualize yourself in this situation. Can you visualize yourself in this situation of life, which we find in John 13? It's part of what we read each Passover season. And it has to do with, after coming to know God, the relationship we have with him and the closeness, because of what we think of him and how we are drawn to him because of his qualities and characteristics. In John 13 and verse 21, which was, I believe, at or after the washing of the feet, but before the communion, as it is called. John 13 and verse 21. Well, verse 20, Jesus said, I'm telling you the truth. I'm leveling with you, fellows. Verse 21 it is. I'm sorry. That was the second time the cold hit my brain. Verse 21, when Jesus had said this, he was troubled, and he said, of a truth, one of you is going to betray me. Now, that's always a way to get attention. One of you is going to. Well, they looked at each other, and they wondered who he was talking about. Verse 23, there was one leaning on the bosom of Jesus. I thought if you got acquainted with him, knowing he had that much power, you'd be terrified and frightened. You wouldn't even want to get close. One of the disciples was actually leaning on the bosom of Jesus. There was that closeness. A human love, shall we say, among men. Not homosexuality at all. Maybe you experienced that in athletic circles, in football or basketball. You're worked out, or you're beginning to start before starting the game. You're sitting around, and the coach is giving you instructions, and you're leaning back, your back against the bosom or chest of one of the other players. And it's a comfortable situation, and it's a camaraderie. It's kind of a brotherly situation, and it is a wonderful experience to have that close human relationship because of the respect and somewhat admiration of your fellow human beings in the same endeavor, athletics in this case. Here was the Messiah and the men he was teaching, mentoring. They were to be the leaders in the world tomorrow. And he said, one of you is going to betray me. And one of them was leaning back on Christ's bosom. And it was the one that Jesus loved. Well, Peter, he didn't yet have that closeness. It didn't say Peter was leaning against him, because Peter had mouthed off to Jesus a few times and saying, long as I'm here, nothing's going to happen to you. And Jesus told him, your attitude is wrong. You've been influenced by the adversary. Peter beckoned to John, who it was, and said, ask him who it is. Why didn't Peter just say, well, who is it? He, lying on Jesus' breast, said, who is it? And Jesus didn't give any. He wasn't ambiguous. He said, it's the one to whom I give us up, but they had no idea who he meant then. Can you see yourself in this position? This is what is called non-verbal touching. Most men never, ever, ever learn that in their marital days, that it means a tremendous, wonderful thing in their marriage to their wife. Just the non-verbal touching. This was non-verbal touching among men in a wholesome way. Jesus certainly had no homosexual thoughts, and John didn't at this time. It was the band of brothers at a bad time in the lives of all of them because of what was going to happen. Can you envision yourself leaning on the breast of Jesus as your older brother, or on the breast of the Father, your Father in heaven? Maybe someday it will be. I never remember that with my father or my brothers, but I do remember it with our sons in the cruel winters in Indianapolis. We would have sometimes a Friday evening meal around the fireplace, and we'd be sitting there after the meal talking, and either one of the sons or both would be leaning on my chest, or I'd be leaning back on one of their chests, and it was just a wonderful feeling, and I still remember that with great fondness, and it is one of the reasons that even yet now we have a close relationship as father and son. And it's just a part of that. When you love someone, respect someone, that you're able to do that. As I said, if Jesus walked into the room, what would be your impression? What would be your reaction? How would you react to that individual? Many great men and women have come and gone. It's amazing how many of the great that we've known in decades gone by are now dead. In those days, they were towering giants among the masses. They commanded the attention. They were on television and news, and their pictures were always in the newspapers, and they attracted people. When they walked into the room, people gravitated to them. They were eulogized, idolized, and immortalized. And yet, they were mere mortals, and they died. Many, even during their lives, showed their imperfections and lack of character, or sins, in many cases. Others, their imperfections and sins were made known after their death. I never knew he was that way. I had no idea that those were the skeletons in his closet. And people were disillusioned after the death of their idol or hero. Just read the other day of this McQueen, I think his name was, a fashion icon in London, 40 years of age, suddenly dead. But they clamored for his business. He was an icon. Must have had some difficulty. You don't just naturally die at 40. It's always that way with human beings, those with looks, brains, talent, money, and accomplishment, charisma, and an aura about them. And there have been many, and there will be many. The masses were drawn to them. Only after the fact to find out that their hero or heroines, their idols, had chinks in their army, chinks in their armor. In other words, they had imperfections, sometimes great imperfections in their character, and for some even hideous sins. And you're just totally disillusioned. Sometimes people just give up. I remember when we pastored in Charlotte and Lenore in the 70s, a family just up and left the church when I found out why they had finally, after years of, after the fact, found out what had happened in one of the leading ministers of the Church of God at that time had done. They just quit. It affected them so greatly when they found out the imperfections. They just gave up and quit. It is not that way with God our Father and Jesus Christ our Savior and older brother. They are confident, yes. They may act, oh, I shouldn't say act, their words may sound like they're arrogant, but they're not. They know who they are, and they are great, and their accomplishments are great, and their plan is incredibly great for having a family of God. And they know it's their show. It's not mine or yours. Yet they're very approachable and very humble, and they have the abundance mentality that they're willing to share it all. That place in the New Testament, it's Hebrews, I think it said, you know, he didn't think that being God was something to be hanged on to. Sounds like he didn't have any value. It just meant he was willing to give it up if it could accomplish the family of God and make it possible that all others could come into the family of God. He had that abundance mentality that he wanted to share it all, and by his death he made it possible that it could all be shared to all. They know it's their share, their show, but they're very, very approachable and humble. And they actually encourage us to approach them, which we do, and to our surprise, we find that all they say about themselves is true. And we're not disappointed in getting to know them and spending time with them. I think for that reason that we need to imbibe the meaning of Hebrews 12, verse 28, a little more as we grow older in the truth. Let's look at that in Hebrews 12, verse 28. Paul speaking to the church, we, including himself, we, and we can apply it to ourselves, we receiving a kingdom. Now, the gospel is the good news about God's kingdom. And it's good news because all of the teachings, all of the laws, all of the statutes and the judgments, all the decisions about the kingdom of God, all of the ways of life that are taught are far superior to what we see in the nations and governments of the world around us today. That's why it's good news. So are we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved? Let us have grace, which can mean graciousness toward life, toward all others, which means favor, which means pardon also. Let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence, not being cowed by them, but to revere them or to be in awe of them and a godly respect. To be in awe of them and yet respect them and feel close to them and know that they love us dearly. If God walked into the room today, either the Father or Jesus, and engaged us in conversation, what would we talk about? Who won the Super Bowl? After hours of talking, would we still be impressed or disillusioned? The more we know human celebrities, the more we're disappointed and disillusioned. But the more we know the Father and Jesus Christ, the more we realize how truly great and genuine they are.